Could we talk about your move to Alaska, exactly when that was, and most importantly, the reasons surrounding the move?
Okay. We came to Alaska in September of 1970 to a school in Larson Bay. The school at the end of August and beginning of September didn't have a teacher, so the superintendent of the school here in Kodiak, Dr. Marshall Lynn, knew a Dr. Paul Jensen that lived in Monmouth and at the school there at OCE. And Dr. Jensen had Doyle in a class, and he knew that he wanted to come to Alaska sometime or another. So he called him and asked him if he would like to come over and talk about Alaska. We really didn't know that this was going to be an interview as such, but anyhow, we went to his house, and he said that there was an opening in Larson Bay for two teachers, and I had just gotten my degree, and I didn't have a job, and so it seemed kind of opportune for us. And so we got on the telephone with Dr. Lynn at his home and interviewed over the telephone. And we were hired in like the middle of August, like the 25th or something like that. Doyle had already been working at the school there, and he had to get out of his contract at the junior high there in Independence. And then we closed up a 5-bedroom house, and we were here the 5th of September with four kids in tow.
Oh, so you have the four children. What are the children's names?
Okay, they're our oldest is Gwen, our only daughter, and then our sons Ken, Dennis, and Ben.
That was a big move from where you were to Alaska. My
right.
Goodness, were you excited about that?
Yes, excited, and a little scared, I think, moving so far away from home.
So tell me about the trip. How did you get here?
Well, we came on Western. I thought I told you the other day it was Ween, but it was actually Western Airlines. And it was a prop plane, and we flew direct from Seattle to Kodiak, and took 5.5 hours. I thought we'd never get here. But and then when we stayed that night, overnight in the KI, which was Kodiak Inn, which is now the Westmark, which I still call the KI, and a lot of people here in town do, when they knew it, if they knew it back in those days. And then we took Kodiak Western Goose out to Larson Bay.
Goose? Now I'm not familiar with that plane.
Okay, that's a plane, a Grumman Goose. And it holds, I think they hold about 7 or 8 people, something like that, plus a pilot. And so we Doyle and I and our four kids and all of our, we came here with 16 pieces of luggage. All that we owned in the world we brought to Alaska in 16, well, it wasn't all that we owned, but we left all the rest of it in storage in Oregon, but that's what we brought with us, 16 pieces of luggage, and one of them was a big truck. And we put all that in the Goose and took off from the channel where the Kodiak Western building was. And the unique thing about the Goose is that it has wheels on it that can drive on land, and then you can drive right into the water, and then it's a float plane, and the wheels come up into the body of the plane, and you take off from the water. And then when you get to wherever you're going, you land in the water, and then he puts down the wheels and drives up on the land and lets you out. And that's the way he dumped us on the shore down in Larson Bay.
It sounds like the...
We had our kids and our 16 pieces of luggage, and I thought I was at the end of the world.
Were the children very apprehensive about the ride out there?
Oh, yes. Our son, the oldest son, is afraid of heights, and it was a very bumpy ride, our first flight on a little bitty plane anyway. And his fingers were glued to the seat. He was hanging onto the seat bottom, and we had to unpry his fingers, his white-knuckled little fingers, when we got there. He was scared to death.
Now, exactly where is Larson Bay? Isn't it due west of Kodiak?
Well, it's west and what I would say southwest, I guess. And it's about a 40 to 45-minute flight by airplane. I don't know how many miles it is exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell me what your reaction was when you arrived in Larsen Bay.
Well, like I said, I thought I was at the end of the world. Or if not at the end, you could see it from there anyway. So I just looked at my husband and I said, whoa, what have we gotten ourselves into? Because it was really a cultural shock coming from, well, we didn't live in the city in Oregon, but it was definitely a whole lot bigger than a village was. The village had about 75 to 80 people. And the school was a two-room school, and the average the student body was between 25 and I think our highest at one point was about 32 students, and four of those, of course, were our own kids, so there weren't that many children in the village. And it was different.
So what exactly did you have in the school? Rooms and so forth, and how many teachers were there? How many people were on the staff?
There were just the two teachers. My husband was what they call the principal, the teacher principal, and then I was, and he had the upper five grades. Let's see, he had the fourth through the eighth grade, so that would be five grades, and I had the kindergarten through the third graders, and there were just two rooms, and we had a full-time aide, and that was Mona Johnson, and who worked with, we shared her between the two of us. For the day, and then we had a Scotty Brunton was our custodian, and he also was hired by the school district to keep the generators going because the electricity for the school were these great big humongous diesel generators, and we didn't know how anything about those, so it's a good thing that Scotty was there because he kept them going. In fact, a kind of a weird thing happened one night. We were in bed asleep in the middle of the night, and we both woke up and said, "What was that?" And it wasn't that anything that any sound had come, it was that the generator had quit, and it woke us up, because the generators went night and day, and all the time, and when it quit in the middle of the night, it woke us both up, because all of a sudden it was quiet. It woke Scotty up, too.
So tell me about the area that you were in, just exactly what was on Larsen Bay.
Larsen Bay is a fishing village mostly, and although there were large canneries there at one time, the canneries weren't working when we were there, the particular year that we were there, but the buildings were left, and that's where our store was in the, it was the cannery store, and the post office was in the store also, and these planes that we flew out there with, they were our link to the outside world. In fact, it got so after we'd been there a while that you could hear that plane coming like about 2 or 3 miles away, the mail plane, because that was your tie to your family or whoever you left back home, you know, or town or whatever. You know, it brought in all kinds of supplies, food, and besides the mail.
I would assume then that it was pretty expensive, the food.
Oh, yes, very.
Mm-hmm. Oh, what did you do for entertainment on Larsen Bay?
Oh, well, this was in 1970. They didn't have TV out there. In fact, there wasn't too much TV in town even, I don't think. So we decided that, in fact, I think Pictures Incorporated from Anchorage sent us a catalog of films. Oh, maybe we need to set this up a little bit, do you suppose? Maybe. I don't know. It's still going, but I don't know if they can hear me or not. Anyhow, they sent us a catalog of films, and we decided that we would rent films and then charge the people to come and see them, and then we would buy something for the school with the money if we made any money, because the films rented for, oh, between, I'd say about $60, and the more expensive ones maybe went up to $120 or something like that. But we thought, well, for the good ones, we could probably pay that, or we could, it would all even out in the long run or something or other. Our very first film that we rented was Old Yeller, and the village folks, they just really loved it, and so we showed it on Friday night, and then they wanted to see it again on Saturday night, so we said, well, maybe this is a two-nighter, so we did it again on Saturday night, and we popped popcorn and put it in a yellow, or not a yellow, but a big rubber waste basket, and then sacked it up and sold the popcorn, and we made juice, Kool-Aid, and we sold that, and we made enough money then to buy books for the library and also to buy a wide-angle lens for the 16 millimeter, because a lot of the movies came were wide-angle films, and you had to. And then we put paper up, because we didn't have big screens, we put paper up across the whole front of the classroom so that the wide-angle movie could be shown on the screen, this homemade screen. So that was our entertainment in the village.
It sounds like a pretty inventive way of getting money. You mentioned that there was a library. Was this in the high school, or was this something separate?
There were no high schools in the.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I meant in the school.
In the school. It was just in the upper grades schoolroom in the corner. There was some bookcases that had the books for the library. It was kind of a informal kind of library. The teachers were in charge of checking things in and out.
How long did you stay in Larson Bay?
We were there for just that one school year from September. Actually, school was out for us about the 15th of May, because we went to school on Saturday. There was the kids were at school anyhow, and there wasn't anything else to do in town, so we went after Christmas. I think we went just about every Saturday, because the weather wasn't so great anyhow. They couldn't play outside, so we made up about 2 weeks of time there by going to school on Saturdays, and so school was out about the 15th of May. One day I remember in about the middle of February, it was a day like today, which was nice, and we'd had about a week and a half of ucky weather. We called school on account of sunshine and went and had a picnic. You can do that when you're the only teachers in the village.
I'm sure the children appreciated
they
that.
They did, yeah, they liked that. Mm.
So what made you leave Larson Bay?
Okay, our daughter was an eighth grader, and there were no high schools in the villages at that particular time. I looked up yesterday just to make sure when that Molly Hooch case came before the legislature in Alaska, and it was in 1975.
Explain that to me.
That's please. Well, Molly was a girl that was in a village somewhere, I'm not sure where, and she and her family decided that she should be able to go to high school in her village rather than go to a boarding school somewhere else, you know. And so they brought this case before the legislature, and it was decided that the villages in Alaska should have high schools, should provide high schools for their students. So that's what's known as the Molly Hooch case. So that's when they began building high schools in villages. But at this particular time in 71, they didn't have high schools. So Gwen would have had to move into town, and it would have, we just wouldn't have done that. We would have probably moved back to Oregon if we couldn't have had positions in town. We asked the superintendent if there would be teaching positions in town, and he said yes, there were. In fact, the counselor at the junior high was leaving that year. I'm not sure if she was going back to school or if she was just leaving permanently. I think she left permanently, because I don't think she came back. And Doyle wanted to get back into counseling too, because that's what he had been doing before in Oregon. And then there was a job at the base elementary school in second grade for me.
So you really felt you wanted to stay in Alaska then?
Yeah, we liked it. Uh-huh. The kids loved the village. In fact, we would have stayed there longer if there had been a high school, you know, because they really enjoyed the being kind of out in the wilderness. They enjoyed it.
So from 1971 then, you moved into Kodiak?
Into Kodiak, mm-hmm.
And tell me about that trip.
We left the village around the middle of May, and we came into town, and we thought, well, are we going to rent, or are we going to buy a house, or what? And so we talked around with the teachers here in town, and they said, well, Bill and Ann Barker, their house is for sale, so we went out and looked at it. And on Thursday, and then we went and looked at another house too that same day, and we decided that their price was right. It was Doyle said it was $27,500, so that sounded like a good price. The other one was like $55,000, and we thought, whoa, that's too much money.
What size houses were both of these?
Now, Bill and Ann Barker's is two bedroom and was on a large lot on Mill Bay, and the other house that we looked at was did have an apartment in the downstairs, so it was an income property, and it was on Resinoff, and we thought it would be noisy. It's right there on Potato Patch on Resinoff, and of course it was $55,000 seemed like a terrible amount of money. So we on Friday we looked at the house on Thursday, we bought it on Friday, and we left town on Saturday. We went back to Oregon for the summer.
So then immediately after you came back, you started school, and where was that?
Mm-hmm. I started teaching at, when we left, when we came into town then, I knew that I would be at Bates Elementary School at the second grade, so we checked out where we would be teaching, and so that's what we did when we came back then. I taught at Bates for second grade for 2 years. And Doyle went back into counseling, and then we asked for a leave of absence to go back to school. And I wanted to get my master's degree in library so that I could do the library out at Bates Elementary School, because I knew the librarian there was retiring.
The Navy was here during that time.
That's correct, yeah. At least the first year that we were there, I had Navy and Coast Guard kids, and I think maybe some the second year too, but I think the year that we were gone in 73-74, the Navy pulled out.
Do you recall how many children were in the classroom at that time?
There were lots, let's see. I think the first year I was out there, I think I had 28, and the second year in my second grade, and I think the second year I had 29 in my second grade class.
Far exceeded the numbers than Larson Bay.
Yes, right, yes.
And your husband, where was he teaching?
He was the counselor at the junior high, mm-hmm. here in town.
So how long did you stay in this house that you purchased from the Barkers?
Let's see. We were in that house. Until we built the one that we're living in now on Larch Street, and then we built that one 16 years ago. So let's see, how many years was that? Until about 78? 78 or 79, I think, is when we built the new house on Larch Street.
What can you tell me about Kodiak during that time? What were the stores like? What were the roads like?
Well, the stores, there was only Kraft's downtown. That was the store, and City Market, of course. I can't remember when they built Waldo's, but I think it was in the 80s when Waldo's was built. And of course, Safeways is just a recent addition. So, and the roads, they seem to be better then than they are now. And of course, the Resinoff extension was not there. Resinoff only went as far as where East is, East Elementary. And the main town, the main thoroughfare through town, I think, was Mill Bay Road, because we always drove Mill Bay Road. Of course, we lived on Mill Bay. So.
And the biggest source of entertainment in Kodiak, what was that?
Well, the theater was there, and for us, though, was our kids' activities in school and basketball and things like that, and wrestling. In fact, my husband for many years was a referee in basketball. He refereed basketball games.
I've always found the people in Kodiak were very, very friendly at that particular point. Do you find that they were equally so, or more so?
Oh, I think Kodiak has a special flavor for friendliness, I think. It's a lot, unlike a lot of places in the lower 48, and unlike a lot of places in Alaska, too. I think there's a special bond with the people here that you don't find other places.
And traffic-wise?
Oh, it was a lot less then. There weren't near as many cars on the island as there are now.
The children fit in very well here in Kodiak?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
So you stayed out at the base for how long?
I was there in teaching second grade until 73, 74. We asked for a leave of absence to go back so I could get my master's degree, go back to school. And so we left and took all of our kids and went down below. And I worked on my master's degree that year, 73, 74, and got it that year. So then we came back. And I expected to be full-time librarian at the Bayes Elementary School because that's the position had been there when I left. But in the meantime, due to budget crunches or whatever, they decreased the librarian's job to half-time. So in 74, 75, the year that we came back, I was half-time librarian in the morning at Bayes Elementary, and in the afternoon had kindergarten kids at Main Elementary School because Elizabeth Santoro, the other kindergarten teacher, had such huge classes that they, I think they took off 8 from each, her morning and her afternoon class, and I had 16 kids in the afternoon, 16 kindergarten class. And that was a precious time. Those kids were good.
Can you recall who was on the faculty at Peterson at that time?
No other than the principal was Don Peterson, who the school was named Bayes Elementary then, but now it's Peterson Elementary, and it was named after him after he died in an unfortunate hunting accident at Thanksgiving time.
So after leaving Peterson, then what happened then?
That year that I was half-time librarian at Bayes Elementary and a half-time kindergarten teacher, my friend Carol Higgle said, well, I think that the librarian at the college wants to get back into teaching English, so you should go see Carolyn Floyd about maybe you could be the librarian at the college. And I said, oh, I don't know about that. But I did come out to talk to Carolyn, and she said that, yes, Frances did want to get back into teaching English full-time, and so I made application, and I was hired then in the fall of 75 for the librarian's job here at the college.
I'm sure you must have seen many changes over the years. Could you tell me about those changes?
Well, yes, when I hired on, the library was one big open room about this size at the end of the hall where the present business offices are, and adjacent to the patio there, the big windows in the patio. Those big windows were in the library. And there was an old door on the library. It was open. And there were about, I think there were about 4,000 volumes when I came to work. So, mm-hmm. And there were 5 or 6. I wrote down the faculty members. There was Frances. She was Frances Rutledge then. Now she's Frances Cater. And there was Mark White and Gary Stevens. And Ron Lind was our business teacher. And Monroe Gonzalez was a media faculty member person, plus myself. And now we have 9 faculty members. So we've grown a little bit over the time.
And how many of these that you mentioned are still with you?
Still here are just Gary and myself.
Oh, you're the old timers.
We're the old timers.
Who has seniority here?
Oh, he does, and he holds it over my head by about a week.
So tell me about the changes now. How many books do you have in the library now?
Now we have, about books is about 24,000, I think, roughly, and titles about 22,000, I'd say. There are encyclopedia sets have more than one volume in them, so there's more volumes than there are titles. But I'd say we have around 22,000 titles.
And you also have Gnosis here, and
oh yes, Gnosis is the university's automated system for keeping track. It's a database. It has a record of all the books that the university owns, whether it's in Nome or Fairbanks or in Juneau or Kodiak or wherever. And that was a big job, that we had to get all of our records onto Gnosis, which was a linking project that we began in, I think, in 1985. And it took us about, we just finished up with the reference collection last fall. So it took us a good long time, about 5 or 6 years, to get everything on there.
When you refer to us, would that be?
Well, that'd be our helpers. My helpers in the library.
How many do you have?
I have three people that work for me. Mignon Brown is my library aide, and Janet Bain is the media tech. And then Steve Krieber is a media tech also. He has the TV. He does the TV station. It's cool.
I know we talked about the automating the library, but I didn't ask you about the preparation in, as far as Bunny Benson Building was concerned. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Okay. In September, I believe it was, in 1979, they began the clearing the land here and getting ready to make an addition to the Bunny Benson Building of what would be the library addition, and also these three classrooms, one of which we're sitting in. And they made a, like I told you yesterday, a big hole out here to put in the foundation for the building, and it filled up with water in the wintertime. We had a big swimming pool out here. But they began in 79, and I think the building was completed sometime in 81. And I think it was in the summer of 81, and that we moved in right at the beginning of the school year of 81. In the meantime, because of the construction that they had started here, we had to move out of where we were at the end of the building, the big room at the end of the building, and we moved into two classrooms, into what used to be room two. I don't know what the number of it. I think it's 107 now. And that was the main circulating collection, and then we moved the reference books into what is now the bookstore, into that room. So the library was in two different places for that 1 year, that the 80-81, I think, that when actual construction was going on. And then in the fall then of 81, then we moved all the books from there into where they are now, thank goodness. It was a big chore.
What other changes can you recall in connection with the library?
Okay, in 1989, I believe that's when Carolyn Floyd retired, the council, the college council, decided that the library maybe should have a name, so we decided that we would call the library the Carolyn Floyd Library.
Why was that?
So, because of all her work, she was the first director, sometimes called a president, sometimes called a director. I think there was other terms too that were over the years the terms changed, but she was always our leader here at the college, which was originally the community college, and I believe it was started, and they held their first classes in the high school in 1968, and then the Bunny Benson Building was built, and I believe they moved out here in the fall of 1972, and as I say, the library was at the end of the hall in an open room, and then when they built the new kind of enclosed library, it has a door now that you can lock. It was felt that it would be nice to name the library after somebody who had worked for so many years and built under her direction. All these buildings were built. And the student body had increased many times over with her direction.
And I noticed that there's a photograph of her in the hall.
That's right. We had this large photograph and with a plaque underneath for dedication when we dedicated the library and named it the Carolyn Floyd Library. And that was in August of 1989.
Well, I know she's very deserving of that recognition.
Right.
Finally, I feel that I must ask a question which was asked in a recent midterm of Dr. Stevens' Alaskan history class, and that is, Do you feel that Alaska is unique? And if so, please tell me about it.
I think it's very unique in that it has been really an opportunity for my husband and I to grow in education here, because when we came it was a lot different than it is today, and I'm not sure I would want to enter education today the way it is. But then it was a very great opportunity, and we were very pleased that we were asked to come and help be here in this place at this time. My husband has retired. He's been retired 2 years. He retired from the counseling job at the junior high. And I'm not sure when I'm going to retire, because I'm having so much fun here at the college. But
your children, are they still here?
Our children are still here. Our daughter is here. She has three grandchildren. We have three grandchildren. And they are here, and they love Kodiak. Our son is the manager at the produce part of Crafts downtown. Our youngest son is in Oregon going to school, hoping to enter into education and get an education degree. And we don't know where he'll end up, because he's marrying a gal down there. He probably will stay down there. But all of them have just loved Kodiak, especially, in Alaska, and in general. I've been to lots of other places in Alaska. I've visited Nome and Fairbanks and Juneau and Sitka and Haines and Valdez. I haven't been to, well, I was at Cordova one time, and Anchorage, of course. You have to go to Anchorage to get to anywhere else in the state. But no place in Alaska is quite like Kodiak.
That's truly a very nice thing to say about the community that you live in. Well, I must thank you very much for being so cooperative and very open. And thank you very much, Charlotte. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.